Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A strong July comes to a close as tech giants wow the street. Congress is hitting a wall on a new stimulus package. And the U.S. dollar plunges, and our guest today, back by popular demand, Ben Hunt, creator of Epsilon Theory and co-founder of Second Foundation Partners. All this and much more on episode number 673 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, now we have hurricanes to add to the mix. Welcome to South Florida. That's what this all comes from. The studio here at Horowitz & Company in sunny sometimes and hurricane season sometimes, Fort Lauderdale. Well, good day and welcome to the show. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm the founder of Horowitz & Company. I'm also the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as the co-host of DH Unplugged with John C. Dvorak. Each and every week we come to you, well, let's start off with what's going on with the hurricane. You probably want to know, and I wanted to get this recorded before the storm starts and kind of gets its way over to my area. And to make sure that we didn't get hit and then we didn't have a show for this week, well, made sure to get this out early. I'm sure everything's going to be fine. Listen, you know, we've had these before. It looks like it's going to graze my area, tropical storm kind of action. And we're kind of used to that down here. Throughout the summer and the afternoons, at any given time, we can have just this crazy, you know, tree-bending, rain-filled storm that comes by. And it's here for 15, 20 minutes, and then, or maybe longer, and everything's flooded. Then everything just, you know, dissipates and you're fine. But this will be a lot longer, of course. It looks like it's going to be a little bit further north, and then scrape by the entire eastern seaboard. I mean, we don't need this right now. What are they calling it? They're calling it COVID-cane. Right in the middle of this pandemic, we get this horrible weather that's going to pretty much run the whole course to a degree of the eastern seaboard, which is so hard hit by this horrible situation with the virus and pandemic. But you know, we can't stop Mother Nature. And I mean, this is a double whammy. It's like we did something to somebody to piss somebody off in 2020. It just doesn't seem to end. But I'm pretty excited about the show today. That being this, you know, the kind of underside of what's happening outside. We have a great guest coming on. We had the close of the month and it was a great July. I mean, in particular for non-US denominated assets, we saw that the dollar took a substantial hit for a lot of different reasons, and emerging market stocks and bonds outperformed dramatically. And we saw some incredible moves on alternative assets like gold, silver, the crypto space. I mean, it was a pretty good month overall. Listen, that's not to put any negative spin on what happened to U.S. equities. It was a great month. Anytime you can get a 5% or 4% equity move on an index for a month, I'll take it. But even that, we have the employment benefits running out, a negative 32% annualized GDP, doesn't seem to faze markets at all because it was all about a couple of things. It's all about the earnings beat. We talked about this a little bit, about 80% of companies have beaten earnings. Yeah, it was a low bar, but that was better. There's a prospect of more stimulus. We have ZIRP, zero interest rate program. And that's how the markets are running these days, right? They're running on the idea of more stimulus, the hope that things will get better in the future, not as bad as maybe was expected. And we saw plenty of speculation. During the month of July, the worst stocks, actually not only the month of July, but let's go back to the March 23rd low. Some of the worst stocks that had a really big sell-off. I mean, in particular, the zombie stocks. They did really well. And I looked at some reporting done on this. And when I'm talking about zombie stocks, these are companies that are money losers. I talked about this in detail on DH Unplugged this week. But basically what we saw was that the Russell 2000, which is the 2000 smallest stocks on a comparative basis in the Russell 3000. So the Russell breaks up their 3000 stock universe by the 1000 largest stocks and the 2000 stocks below that in terms of market capitalization. So when you look at this, pretty amazing. The companies in the Russell 2000 index that are money losers or these zombies, negative earnings, no earnings, are up 79% on average since the March 23rd low. That's pretty impressive. But what's really weird is the fact that the profitable companies, those companies that have not had the same situation where they're just kind of lurking around, hanging on by a thread, with no prospect for income. But I'm talking about the money, the companies that have money and earnings in that same index are only up 47%. So the zombies are up 79%. The profitable companies are up 47% since the March low. What does that say? I think what we can discern from that is it's showing the benefit of an easy monetary policy and how the fact that we see incredible amounts of money going into the debt to float these companies are helping them stay relevant. The problem is the policy also enables speculative behavior. And I don't know of any other really good analysis very clearly stated that shows anything to this more than the fact the zombie companies are outperforming. Now, it's not necessarily bad. It's not like, oh my gosh, let's run for the... No, it's not like that. It's just a data point that we need to consider, the fact that there is an excess amount of speculation, which, by the way, we know can run for a long period of time. It's not something new. We've seen this before. Question is, where does it end up, and how do we get out of this? How do we get out of the reliance on the stimulus, tax benefits, financial engineering, and simply the wealth effect? Is there any way out of this? Because if not, there's really no way that the economy at large, the entirety of the economy and those people that are not necessarily benefited by the wealth effect or tax breaks or more debt can get back on their feet and then consume and then have a great economy that is based on holistic generation of continued growth and earnings and spending. Now, on top of that, we know there's a kind of a, I guess we could think of a massive, what do we call, warping of the space market cap continuum, right? It's kind of, we see that the larger stocks are getting larger. And on Friday in particular, the end of the month, July 30th, we saw this in full force. We saw Facebook and Apple and Google and Amazon all reporting. Now, Facebook did well. Apple went, you know, up incredibly. Amazon did very well. Blowout numbers. Google, there was some concern. But we saw the NASDAQ 100 towards the end of the day, up 1.25%. And at the same time, with that index up 1.25%, 75% of its index members, other than, you know, that, were down on the day. The breadth on the day was overwhelmingly decliners, 3-1 at one point. We had a bit of a rally towards the end of the day. But nonetheless, this is telling you how top-heavy and how important these names are for the market cap weighted indices. Now, Apple did something interesting this week. Apple came in with a stock split. So they announced a four for one stock split effective mid-August. And that kind of scratching my head on this, saying, you know, huh, why would they do that in a time when it doesn't really matter, it seems, to investors what the price of a stock is, but it's going to have a pretty important impact on one specific index. Because it's not going to change the weighting in the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ Qs, because it's all based on market cap, and a split doesn't change your capitalization of the company itself. Just divides the shares and then get more shares. So you get more shares into your portfolio at a lower price. It all is the same exact number at the end of the day. So if Apple is closing in around, $400 per share, that means that a 4-for-1 split will be $100 per share. So I think that is going to be kind of interesting, because it's going to impact the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is a price-weighted index. And the price-weighted index right now, Apple being one of the most important names, if not the most important name, in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, is incredible. Because what it's going to do is it's going to have, after the split, about the same weighting as JP Morgan, but one half of that of Microsoft and McDonald's. It'll be one third of the weight of Home Depot, but the same weighting as Nike. So there's some questions as to why they're doing this. I mean, there are fractional shares available right now by a lot of brokers where you can go in and buy, let's say, 0.5, 0.2 of a share. And therefore, you're spending less money. You don't have to buy a full share, which is $400. There's some concept that they came out with that Apple's saying that they want to make it more available to the masses, to the average investor. But that doesn't really hold up well due to this fractional share opportunity. Maybe it's for liquidity. I mean, it could be the higher the price of the shares, the more potential for the spread, and therefore that if you drop the price down, there's going to be more liquidity because the spreads tighten up. Or maybe it's just simply because it makes the price look cheaper, but I'm not exactly sure what that's all about. But on top of their decent earnings and good numbers and outlook that wasn't as dire and all the people spending money on their technology and their tools, well, stock was up like 10%. 10%, which accounted for a total of about 250 points on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down most of the day until the last hour. We're going to talk about that in a second. It's the highest price name in the index. So perhaps it's designed to make the Dow Jones Industrial Average more diversified, have less of a concentration. I don't know why Apple would take the lead. Maybe they were kind of nudged by the Dow Jones Industrial Average index creators, possibly. I don't know, maybe. Because I don't think that holds up well either, because there's a lot of names in the $200 to $300 range also. So unless they're going to be starting with stock splits and getting everybody to the same approximate price somehow to level off what it is to make the Dow Jones Industrial Average more relevant, I don't know. Something's interesting there. We'll find out more about this, I'm sure, in an upcoming discussion somewhere along the way. In other news of note, the U.S. dollar is down about, 9% now in the month, in the last couple of months, right? So since about the high in April, there's a lot of reasons for this. I think a lot of them make sense. But it appears that the U.S. is having if you look out around the world, at least from what we see, probably the toughest time with taming this pandemic, right? So in the developed world, let's kind of look at that. And with that in mind, if you think about if the economics are reflective of, not the stock market, the economics are reflected in the path of the pandemic, then it makes sense that we're going to have the worst economic recovery compared to other companies for a while. And that means that the Fed is in play a lot longer. And then we could then, push that out to the idea that it stands to reason that until we turn the corner on this pandemic, weakness is going to be seen in the greenback. And this could be, if it stays this and continues this process and path, I think it could be a really interesting and important turning point for non-U.S. equities. And turning back to what we discussed last week, if you remember that, the idea of proper diversification, now is a kind of important time to look at, okay, not only where do I have overlap, which we spent a lot of time, and that was your homework assignment from last week, but also what in your portfolio is dollar denominated and what investments are not dollar denominated. You can look at the sectors and companies and how much exposure they have to the U.S. and non-U.S., but also what about your bonds, your foreign investments? How are they priced? Are they priced in local currency or are they priced in dollars? Are they hedged or are they not? So I think that's something also to add as an additional component of that homework assignment we talked about of looking at stock overlap in your portfolios to see if you're really diversified with your ETFs, with your stocks, with your mutual funds. Now, there is the potential for the dollar to move up. But again, I think there's going to be some negative implications on our current structures. As a matter of fact, I'm going to hold that to after our guest, a little teaser on this, but there's a couple of things that I want to talk about, two specific items regarding the U.S. dollar and a little sneaky Pete announcement after the close on Friday, quietly done. Hopefully nobody will notice, but I think it's really directly related to this discussion of the U.S. being, you know, the dollar being under pressure right now. And I think it goes to and it confirms, you know, what's going on and why gold and silver and cryptos and foreign investments and emerging markets have outperformed for the month of July, even though it was a great month for U.S.-based investments. So what you have right now is a situation that you want to really focus on this. But I'm going to talk about that after our guest, but we'll get to that in a second. Quick mention, Mondays afternoon at 4:30 each and every week, we have the pop-up Q&A webinars. And not so much pop-up anymore. Right. They were when we started this out in, when the pandemic really started hitting. So it was probably March. I figured we're going to do this for a couple of months, maybe at best. It's kind of a quick pop up. Let's get the Q&As in there. But the incredible amount of participation and great questions and the amount of people that are attending, I just can't stop at cold turkey right now because I think it's something that people really want. So you could register for that. What we do is we get a quick discussion of what's happening during the week on Mondays. I go through this at 4:30. It's a webinar style, and you get to ask any questions that you want, and I'll do my best to get you the answer. So go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you can click on the registration button and check that out. The other thing I want to mention, I'm really happy that a lot of you took my discussions that we've been having over the last few months about this idea of 1 foot in and 1 foot out, and you implemented it. We've been working with so many clients right now with the idea that, hey, you know what? They were really concerned and afraid and worried about investing with all that's going on. And they were kind of frozen, right? Paralyzed to a point because they didn't know what to do, how to do it, how to get in. They know they probably should have been in something, but what and how? So over the last few months, a lot of clients came to us and said, you know what, that makes a lot of sense, and it's worked out really well. Yeah, there was probably the idea that it should have been all in. That was a better idea, but a lot of people just didn't want to do that. And what we had to do is help people really, I guess essentially, align their longer-term goals with their concerns and fears and rightfully so worries about what's going on in the markets, in the economy, around the world, with the pandemic, you know, all the things that are happening with the election coming up, all the things that we could bring up and discuss as, oh, what about that? What about this? Oh my gosh. But going into a little bit of a broader discussion, and it's worked out really, really well. And I want to thank you. And it feels really good to me that you have taken that and your emails that you've sent me and implemented it. And you got yourself in a position that you're really comfortable and making some money along the way. So keep it up. Thumbs up to you. Being disciplined, being an investor in the environment that you know what's right for you, and implementing appropriate strategies, techniques that we talk about. That's what it's all about on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So why not just get right into right now our discussion with our guest? And our guest today, again, back for another round, is Ben Hunt, and he's the creator of Epsilon Theory and the inspiration behind Second Foundation Partners, which he co-founded with Rusty Gwynn in 2018. And If you haven't read Ben's work, it is, aside from the fact that it is incredibly, incredibly on point, it is so well written with so many different aspects of Ben, you have an unbelievable writing ability.
Oh, that's so kind of you. No, it's a sign of a misspent youth. I, you know, watched too much TV and read too many comic books.
Well, you know, what I find really most amazing about, you know, when you write is that how do you remember all these very interesting little tidbits that you then weave through the story of some novel that you may have read 22 years ago?
You know, I can't really tell you. I mean, it's I just, like I say, I've always just loved to read and watch a lot of movies and TV and always had a good memory for it. I will say this. It's so much easier today because you've got these different, you know, websites that, you know, can refresh your memory on, you know, lines from a book or lines from a movie. So I'm certainly not above taking advantage of that.
So you're not just sitting there with either index cards or big Rolodex that's somehow organized for those people that know what those things are.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah, a Rolodex. So we're really dating ourselves now, right?
Yep. So let's go through some of this because you've done a lot of writing recently on obviously a lot of different topics. You've been, you know, I follow you on Twitter. You're kind of angry right now, or maybe not angry, but you're fed up. Is that the right word?
Fed up for sure.
Yeah.
Fed up for sure. It's the most recent note I wrote was, it's called The Grifters, actually, after a wonderful book and a, you know, just a fantastic movie, right? So it's, you know, John Cusack and Angelica Houston and, Annette Bening, you know, and you know they're grifters. They're con men and women, and it's about that world. And I got to tell you, I just feel like all of us are immersed in this world of cons and grifts. You know, it's just whether it's in politics, whether it's in markets, I'm pretty fed up. You're absolutely right. It's just we're just immersed in it these days.
So I want to
more
talk
so it seems than ever.
I want to talk about different things, but since we're talking about this, we might as well get into this. And it really focused in on the whole Kodak situation. Now, first of all, what is the difference between, in your opinion, between a grift and a graft? Is there a fine line?
Well, a grift is, you know, no, a grift is just a con, right? You know, a grift is a con, and usually it's an ongoing thing, right? It's not some bank heist, right? I mean, a grift is a confidence game that you play over and over and over again, and that's what I see going on, you know, like what we saw with Kodak.
So with Kodak, what happened was that out of the blue, although the stock was up 20% the day before on nothing, and that could have been nothing, maybe. This is a $100 million company that out of nowhere seemingly got $750 million thereabouts in a quote-unquote loan in order to transform one of their facilities from, I guess, silver-plated and film, I guess,
right.
Or whatever they're doing right now there, or whatever they had been doing, creating about 300 jobs approximately that's going to be part of that, to ingredients that are used in the manufacturing of generics to then provide us for an outlet to do it here in the U.S. rather than be reliant on India and China. Is that pretty much the story?
That's pretty much it. But see, here's the thing. And look, and I'm all for, you know, bringing pharmaceutical production back to the United States. Don't get me wrong. I think that's absolutely fantastic, and I'm thrilled for the government to support that and do that. But what is just a grift is that, you know, these politically connected guys up in Rochester, New York, who have zero experience, zero in pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
They're not manufacturing guys. They're marketing guys who took over Kodak, you know, this failed, famous company a couple of years ago. And because of their connections in the White House, they're the ones getting $765 million to, you know, do a pharmaceutical startup, their words, over a period of 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's bullshit, right? That's the grift. That's the con. It's not that you know, we're bringing pharmaceutical production and supply chain back to the United States? Absolutely. Absolutely we should be doing that. But don't tell me that these politically connected guys with zero experience in that, they're going to get $1 billion, right, when we've got hundreds of great, experienced, specialty chemical companies all over the country, right, many of whom already are doing work in pharmaceuticals and pharmaceutical supply. You know, they're right. The ones who should be, you know, building these facilities and getting this sort of assistance money.
So what's interesting is, first of all, is non-recourse and non-securitized
loan. Yep. Yeah, it's just giving them the money.
So the other thing that you didn't talk about, which I did find out about, which I don't know is probably going to really boil you up here, it seems that they're switching from giving out options. They're giving, instead of giving restricted stock grants, they're going to outright just option grants.
Yeah, I mean, but they're only giving that to, like, the very top people, which is another part of this whole thing, right?
Right,
I mean,
right.
So the CEO of the company, the chairman and CEO of the company, he came to the company, or the board hired him about a year and a half ago. Because what you got to understand, the other thing, that 2 years ago, back in 2018, Kodak was trying to reinvent themselves as a Bitcoin company.
I remember that. Right? Oh, I remember that. That was great.
Yeah, right. So is you know, these guys are just professional grifters, and they brought in a new CEO. They gave him, you know, all these options at like $2 a share, and they call up their buddies in the White House, and they're the ones who are getting all this money. The Robin Hood traders come online, they build they bid the stock up to, you know, wherever it is now. And look, in a span of 24 hours, the top three shareholders in the company, they made over $400 million.
So what is this? What's the bigger picture here? What's the bigger picture? So I get this, right? And I get also that there's other things going on in the area of like PPP loans that obviously, that this is the same genre, right? What is the bigger picture here?
Well, the bigger picture is that every con man, and the biggest cons are always business cons, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that. I mean, and what's happening today is it's like just a feeding frenzy. I mean, the troughs have been opened, and if you're connected, if you got a buddy and you can do something that you know, Trump can talk about in a press conference. You know, it's just like blank check season, and it's so disheartening when we are all of us in this country struggling with the greatest public health crisis we've ever faced, or at least in 100 years, and the biggest economic crisis we've ever faced in 100 years.
Right.
That's why I'm fed up. That's why you see the anger and the tweets and the posts and all like that.
So I have this vision of a Shark Week episode that I saw. There was some recording, I think it was in Australia off the Barrier Reef. There was a giant whale that just died, right? You know, somewhere in the ocean. Who knows if it was placed there, but whatever. And these great whites just gorging on its carcass till you could physically see that they were distorted. You know? Okay.
Right.
This is kind of what this looks like in all. I mean, between the EIDL loans, non-repayment. I mean, any time that you announce, like Europe did recently, that we're going to be doing grants. I don't know about you, but my ears perk up. I'm like, oh.
Absolutely.
Grant?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just. And this is your point, right? It's everywhere. It's not just the United States, of course not. But it's like, I expect better.
Yeah.
You know, I really do. Our country is being run like some, you know, third world country where corruption is just a matter of course.
Right. And now, so the next question is a two-part question. So, the first part is this the great game and test of MMT? And what are the actual long-term implications of all this?
Yeah, I think that what typically happens when you see this kind of feeding frenzy, I think your shark example is really, really appropriate, right? And what are those sharks feeding on? They're feeding on a carcass, right?
Yeah, right.
They're feeding on a dead whale, and it feels to me like there's so much of our economy, our politics, it's that dead whale. And so you've got all the sharks around, gorging themselves because that's what sharks do. And that leaves the rest of us fish kind of, hanging around saying, well, what's next? What comes out of this? And I think when you look in human history and you see these periods of this, feeding frenzy of the sharks gorging themselves, it always ends up being a political upheaval, right? These things get cashed out in politics.
When you see politics, you're talking about, but you're talking about more of a societal politics.
You're
not talking about,
I am.
Like, you're not saying Republican versus Democrat. You're talking about in a societal way, like where we had, when we had the sit-ins on Wall Street, and now we have, the multifaceted civil war with, people of color on one side and people of not a color on the other side and people that are LGBT, with all the other letters after there. We see this great, like everybody's being pieced apart. We were a puzzle that was together, but it's all of a sudden there's all these different quadrants and people are pissed.
They are pissed, but I think we're led down a path of being pissed intentionally by the people who we should really be pissed at, right? And what I mean by that is I believe very much that there are real problems of racial injustice and the way justice is applied in this country that boils down to race. What I'm talking about in terms of the much bigger picture, I think, is less of a racial issue and it's much more of a ultra rich versus everyone else issue.
Right.
And I think it's not a Republican or a Democrat thing. It's a power thing, and it's the Venn diagram here, the center of this is in the ultra rich. And I think that these divisions between ourselves, I think they are in many cases constructed and created to preserve this sort of attractive environment. If you're a shark who can feed off the carcass of a big whale,
right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's what I think is going on. And ultimately, like I say, this gets cashed out. But unfortunately, as you say, the politics of this become the politics of division and infighting and violence between citizens who frankly should be on the same side, not opposing sides.
Yeah, because I see this, with our, when you look at the financials behind it, you look at our debt to GDP, the amount of stimulus that we're doing, the amount of unemployed, and I understand there was a pandemic, I got that, which, by the way, could have been avoided. But listen, I traveled, and I don't want to get into a whole mask debate and all that good stuff, but I traveled in January. I think that was the last time I was on a plane, but I traveled in January nonetheless. And in January, there was kind of hints of stuff going on, right? Around the world.
Yep.
And I was going to D.C. and I said, I'm buying myself a mask. I don't care what anybody says on the plane. I don't know what's going on. There's probably a lot of people going into the international airports and all this. I got on the plane with a mask. And of course, everybody's like, what the hell's wrong with you? I'm like, listen, a couple of people are like, hey, where'd you get the mask from? But I walked through the airport and all that. I got out and did my thing. And I met with people and all that without the mask on, of course. But if some very simple things where we would have actually acted, there's no coincidence why we have the worst situations, not just testing. I don't want to get into a whole coronavirus discussion here, but point is that leadership is, in fact, I think from the top down, from the bottom up, is kind of creating this because creating a separation of all of us in so many different ways right now. And it's It has become these haves and have-nots, and that's really a problem.
It sure is. It's the biggest problem. And again, it goes back to what I was saying about it feels like we're being, you know, run like a third world country again.
There's no question about that. No question about that.
And that's the sort of thing that, it should make you angry. It sure as hell makes me angry.
So we have these grifts. We have this inequity. We have all these different problems. How would it, now all these terrible things, third world country, major stimulus, 10, 20, 30 million people unemployed, GDP negative 32%. By the way, GDP negative 32%. The rest of the world is horrified about this number, right? We see German markets get slammed on that and other things, and Europe markets get slammed, and we see that in Asia they pick it up overnight. They're like, oh man, that's really bad. Meanwhile, we're like, ha, because we have this market condition right now that is so weighted towards, once again, same, the rich, not the rich people, but the rich companies.
Yeah.
Right. Same thing.
Sure.
Same thing. So, do we ever get out of this loop? Apple made an attempt to do it in the Dow Jones by splitting 4-for-1, or they're going to. But what takes us out of this? And what takes us out of this mentality that even though I don't have money, I don't have a job, I'm opening up a Robinhood account, I'm trading stocks?
So the problem is that there is no short answer. There's no quick fix for this. There just isn't, right? This is decades in the making, and it's going to be decades in the fixing. And the fix, and I believe this with all my heart, the fix is you have to help your neighbor. I know that doesn't sound big enough, and it doesn't sound sexy enough or that, but it really is getting involved in your community, right? Your local school, right? I don't care if you got kids in the school or not. I really don't care, right? What you need to be this. This is the centerpiece of it's the thread of your local community. And it's not teachers versus parents. That's what people would make you, that's what they want to make you think. Oh, the teachers, they should go back to school, or no, the parents that are being assholes by, forcing the schools open.
Yeah.
Right? That's not the conflict, right?
Right.
We all want the same thing. And we're all scared, and we all want to, protect our families and our communities. It is absolutely just a matter of not blaming the other side for whether they want to open or close or whatever their position is. It's working together, and it can be done. There are lots of examples all over the country of people working together, say, okay, there are going to be some people, even if we open the school, they can't send their kids to the school. How are we going to take care of them? And there are going to be people, all right, if we leave these schools closed, oh, my God, we've got to have something for the parents. They both work. What are they going to do? We've got to fix that. It's a matter of finding the solutions that work for your community and your people and actually doing it. So it's not sitting behind a computer or sending out your tweets, right? It's actually getting involved and figuring out how can we actually do real good in our actual communities. And I know it doesn't sound like
that is a lot.
That is the answer.
It's also
helping your
community.
Man,
listen,
I'm telling you.
When this whole first thing started, I'm like, what can I do, right? I'm like, we're all locked down, we all got a problem. A friend of mine started a little list of people in need, and I went to the store myself, and I filled up a giant basket full of crap. It cost me, to be honest with you, $125. It was the biggest basket of stuff. It wasn't, I just bought, what do you want? Well, she has three kids. She doesn't have a husband. And I took it over to her house and I gave it to her. And you know what? They ate probably 2 weeks worth of food. It cost me $100-something.
And
I have a friend who does work for me in India. His father just died of COVID. And I wrote him, I said, listen, how much does it cost to feed your family? How big is your family? He says, it's two families, 10 people. In India, how much does it cost to feed your family for a week? The whole family. He said like $200. Sent him the $200.
Oh,
not that, listen, I'm not talking about thousands, hundreds. You with your PPE program has been pretty impressive collecting and sending and stuff. But the thing is, just a little bit from each person, a little teeny bit, helps.
It's everything. It's everything. And I'm glad you mentioned the PPE, right? So to date, we've bought and we've distributed over 120,000 N95 masks.
Yeah, that's great.
To over 1,000 hospitals and clinics and police departments and fire departments and prisons and shelters. But it is not a big deal, right?
Right.
I mean, it's just, it's four or five of us we got together and said, hey, let's put this together. And you know, we work a little bit on it every day, and it makes an enormous difference. It's bottom-up things like that that are going to recreate this country. And it's going to take a long time, but, man, it's going to happen.
Yep. By the way, you can find out more about Ben and Epsilon Theory and Second Foundation Partners over on epsilontheory.com, I believe is the right address.
That's it. For you.
Let's just finish this up. First of all, by the way, just to let you know, Ben didn't want to say it. Well, how does he know all these things and write so well? He's a graduate of Vanderbilt and a PhD from Harvard. So just letting you know, this is
I don't talk about that.
I got it. Just let you know. I mean, you know, you got me at the Harvard, at the PhD level. But let's see. So the last thing I want to ask in a couple more minutes that we have left here is, so I know you create portfolios, portfolio models. You do a lot of work in the area of that. And obviously for pension funds and hedge funds and things of that nature. So how, in this really crickety environment, going into an election, going into a negative 32% GDP, probably going to get better, 30 million people unemployed here, central banks, you know, and a gigantic, dead, blubbery carcass in the middle of all this. Mm-hmm. How do you, what do you do? Like, where are we in the investment world?
Well, so you're again, it's an answer I don't think people are going to like, but the answer is our markets today have nothing to do with the real economy. They're totally separate from the real economy. So markets are going up and down depending on what, you know, we like to call the narrative. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do in our company. We're not measuring, you know, retail sales or unemployment or, you know, anything that's happening in the real world. I mean, the important stuff for actual human beings, that doesn't matter for markets anymore. Mm-hmm. What we're measuring is, what are the tweets on this topic? Or, you know, I'm totally serious, man.
I hear you.
What are the transcripts from CNBC this week?
Right.
That's the stuff that we measure, and that's how we evaluate markets today, because they've been totally divorced from actual economic activity in the actual real world.
Yep. Finally, you write a lot about the nudging state. This whole idea that we as humans are pushed into things maybe unbeknownst to us.
Yeah, so that we're nudged.
So exactly. Here's a big nudge. It's more of maybe it's a sledgehammer to the head. I don't know if you've heard about South Africa. I talked to a friend in South Africa, very bad situation down there. They were in a very severe lockdown for a long period of time. They have these very poor neighborhoods there. I don't know if you've been there in Cape Town at all. It's the shanties the potential for healthcare is nothing there, zero. The potential for spread there is enormous of the pandemic. They have shut down, the entire South Africa has shut down the sales of alcohol and cigarettes. Now, my friend's in the alcohol business. He owns the biggest vineyard in mm-hmm. South Africa. And they have to pour out, I don't know why they're pouring this out, but they're pouring out and getting rid of about 40% of their wine. Point is, though, and the question I have about the nudging state is this the giant nudge? I mean, what the hell does alcohol sales and cigarette sales have to do with the pandemic?
Got me. You got me. But look. Both things can be true, meaning that it can be true that we are in the greatest public health crisis of our lifetimes. That is true. Mm-hmm. It can also be true that governments, every government all over the world at every level, uses that public health crisis to try to advance its own aims and agendas. Right.
Yep.
Both things can be true, and it's just so important for all of us to try to distinguish from one to the other.
Yep, I appreciate it. Ben Hunt is here with us again. You can follow him on Twitter. We'll put that information on this show notes for episode number 673 of The Disciplined Investor over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you can go over to epsilontheory.com, sign up for his regular newsletter, and be wowed by his writing and what he talks about. Ben, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye. Always refreshing and a great discussion with such an elegant writer, speaker, and thinker. So that was great. Got to do that again. Really enjoy having him on. All right, before we got to our discussion with Ben, I mentioned a little, just a sneaky little news story that was put out there at the after the close on Friday and how I thought that was kind of interesting. And it related to the U.S. dollar. So This was from Fitch, the rating service that rates bonds and sovereign debt, etc. So Fitch affirms that the United States has a AAA rating. It revised its outlook to negative from stable. And this is what they said. The outlook has been revised to negative to reflect the ongoing deterioration in the U.S. public finances in the absence of a credible fiscal consolidation plan. Issues that were highlighted in the agency's last rating review on March 26, 2020. High fiscal deficits and debt were already rising on a medium-term path even before the onset of the huge economic shock precipitated by the coronavirus. They have started to erode the traditional credit strengths of the U.S. So, again, a little sneaky. Probably didn't want to get a lot of fanfare and ire from the powers that be on this, but I think this is something you're going to see. Now, is this really bad? Still a AAA? Just a negative? I don't think it's anything new. We all knew about this. I mean, things are pretty bad in terms of the economic situation, the debt pileup, the deficits, all the stimulus that's going to come out and how that continues to erode problems, the payback of that with lower taxes, a high unemployment. Nothing new. But it's being noticed. And it's being commented on. And not only that, it's being put down in writing properly. And that is something to take notice of. Now, that probably has some impact on the dollar, although I don't think that much compared to what it is. Again, the dollar was way ahead of this. Everybody knows this, but again, this is one of those situations where nobody was really talking about it too much. And it could be very simply just, okay, we knew that, that's fine. Or it could be the potential for a disrobing of the obvious. And once it's said, it really makes its way through the system. We'll have to see what happens. Last thing I want to mention, I talked about Apple and how it was really important in the indices, right? And how, in particular, it held a very substantial amount of return for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and it's splitting and all that. But I just want to give you a little taste of this so you understand the last 60 minutes of trading on Friday, July 31st, the last 60 minutes of trading, 90 points of the Dow were attributable to Apple, 0.15% on the S&P 500, and a whopping 0.36% of the NASDAQ 100. So now we have a company that is officially the biggest company in the world, surpassing Saudi Aramco with, what, $1.9 trillion of market cap now, give or take. And what's a couple hundred million dollars between friends, right? And still going to have an exceptionally large level of sway on indices. So that 3.5% move in the last 60 minutes on Friday was 0.36% of the NASDAQ. Just think about that. If it, I don't know, somehow falters or continues to do well, it's going to have an undue influence or an outsized influence, not undue, but outsized influence on the markets, particularly for the NASDAQ 100, much less so for the Dow moving forward after the split, and still a reasonable amount for the S&P 500. We're going to wrap it up. I'm going to go home and make sure that my yard is straight. The house is buckled up. All the flashlights and batteries are there at our water. Just making sure, being safe. I'm sure it's going to be fine. Thanks for all your emails. Hit me up on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is my Twitter handle. Just one word, Andrew Horowitz. And I'm going to see you again next week. Thanks so much. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.